morning. Please be seated. We have one case for argument this morning. Lane Wesley versus A. David Floor. The record should reflect that Justice Page is recused from this case. Mr. Wade, you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal. You may proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court. Learned counsel, we're here this morning to respectfully request the court to give effect to the safe harbor provision of Minnesota Statute Section 145.682. Minnesota Statute Section 145.682, enacted in 1986, requires detailed disclosures of an identified expert's opinions within 180 days of commencement in suit. That was done in this case. The safe harbor provision, enacted in 2002 by a nearly unanimous House, allows for correction of any deficiencies in that disclosure. The statute allows 45 days from the time of notice of deficiencies for the plaintiff to correct alleged deficiencies. The statute does not limit the deficiencies which can be corrected.
Counsel, Mr. Hart would tell us, I think, that Brown Wilbert, I keep wanting to say Wilbert Chandler, but Brown Wilbert is significant here and somehow determinative. How would you respond to that?
If Brown Wilbert is important, Norske versus Friedberg is even more important. As Your Honor well knows, the Court of Appeals decision in Norske clearly allows a qualification challenge of an expert to be cured. That is exactly parallel to the 145 statutory scheme. Counsel had the opportunity, defense counsel challenged issued a challenge to the qualification of this expert under 145.682. The statutory scheme says plaintiff's counsel gets 45 days to cure that alleged deficiency. The only difference between 145.682 and 544.42, Your Honor, is that in one circumstance, under 544, the plaintiff's lawyer can first say, yes, the expert is qualified, can argue that vigorously, and if plaintiff's counsel prevails, it's the end of the matter. If plaintiff's counsel fails, he then gets 90 days after the judge rules to fix the deficiency to get a qualified expert, as was held in Norske. In the medical malpractice legislative scheme, it's a little riskier because if you don't dare go to the bank on or argue that your expert is qualified because you don't get to fix it after the judge rules. You have to fix it before the judge rules. It's the only difference.
Let me follow up with Justice Barry Anderson's question. The one thing that bothers me about your position is, and maybe you could respond to this, it seems to me that the qualification of the expert might be the one deficiency that can't be remedied. In other words, there's a requirement of an affidavit of expert disclosure, but the affidavit submitted by your client was the equivalent of no affidavit of expert disclosure at all. In other words, there was not a qualified expert listed anywhere on the face of that affidavit. Why should that not be the rule here? And isn't that supported somewhat by the Brown-Wilbert case?
Well, I don't think it is, Your Honor. In Norske, again, in Norske, that was a qualification issue, and the court held the expert wasn't qualified. What the court didn't go so far as to say, and you can't fix that, because the statute doesn't say you can't fix a qualification challenge. Indeed, the statute says you can fix deficiencies.
Counsel, let me explore that with you for just a second.
Sure.
I don't know, my mic off, or is it on?
You're on.
Okay. I'm a little concerned about how we distinguish between what I call an affidavit of expert review and identification of experts. And what I mean by that is the affidavit of expert review clearly requires that the attorney has a reasonable expectation that the expert's opinions could be admissible at trial.
Yes, sir.
And as we look at subdivision four, the identification of experts, it doesn't say anything about qualifications. And as I look at the affidavit of expert review, as we then go to subdivision six, there's no provision for amending that affidavit. You either have an affidavit with the expert or not. It's only the deficiencies under subdivision four that you can correct. And I guess it's maybe my trial lawyer experience, but you look at, you know, what is a qualified expert under Rule 702, and that's certain, that's something, the qualifications of an expert are something that a judge would look at. And Rule 703 looks at the opinions and the basis of the opinions. And it sure seems to me like subdivision four is directed at the opinions and the basis of the opinions. And that plus the fact that the legislature doesn't allow an amendment under subdivision three seems to take us in a different direction. And I'd like you to respond to that, if, and maybe a different way of, and I'm sorry that I'm convoluted here, but under subdivision three, if you submitted an affidavit by your neighbor, who's obviously a lay person, that would not be a proper, that would not qualify under subdivision three, correct?
Of course not.
And then how would you remedy that under six?
Well, I don't think you could, because you haven't submitted an affidavit at all.
Right. And so I guess my question is, doesn't subdivision four go to the opinions and the basis of the opinions and not the qualifications of the expert? And therefore, you can't correct the failure to disclose a qualified expert.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think under Tefeteller, this court has held that the qualification issue falls within the statute. And it's an appropriate, that qualifications of the expert is one of the bases for challenging an affidavit. And the statute says any challenge deficiency can be corrected.
How do you respond to subdivision four says nothing about qualification of expert?
And that was the argument in Tefeteller. The argument was we're not required. There's no requirement under the statute that the expert be qualified. It's silent on that issue. It only needs these other criterion. And this court said, no, implicit in the statute is a requirement for the qualification of the expert. If the keep in mind, Your Honor, that the defense chose to challenge the qualifications under 145.6A2. They said it's, as Tefeteller holds, qualification is one of the bases for challenge. And if it's one of the bases for challenge, then it must necessarily be one of the bases for correction, because challenge deficiencies can be corrected.
Well, let's take Justice Dietzen's example that he gave you under subdivision.
I'm sorry, Your
Honor. Let's take Justice Dietzen's example that he gave you under subdivision 3 and apply it to subdivision 4. So let's say at the stage of identification of experts, you disclose in the affidavit by plaintiff's attorney or by the plaintiff herself that your neighbor is going to be the expert. And it's completely clear that the neighbor is not in any way an expert. Would that be something that could be remedied under subdivision 6?
No, Your Honor, that's not an affidavit. And there is a line at some point that needs to be drawn. The line I submit is it must be an expert affidavit, and it must render opinions of the expert. As Your Honor is aware, the line has been suggested differently in Brown-Wilbert case, where Justice Hansen said the line is there must be some meaningful information. The problem with drawing the line there under 145.6A2 is that the some meaningful information line was articulated first by Justice Yetka in the Sorenson decision. And if there was some meaningful information disclosed, then it the language of Justice Yetka is in borderline cases where counsel for a plaintiff identifies the experts who will testify and gives some meaningful disclosure of what the testimony will be, there may be less drastic alternatives to a procedural dismissal.
Well, how do we distinguish between an affidavit that identifies a neighbor and an affidavit, and with all due respect to the general practitioner, who would be qualified to probably render a medical opinion in a wide variety of cases, but clearly not in a dental malpractice case, as you conceded. How do we distinguish between the neighbor and somebody who would be an expert in a different type of case, but is not an expert in this particular case?
They have to be an expert, and 145.6A2 actually articulates that a healthcare provider means physician, surgeon, dentist, or other healthcare professional. Obviously not a neighbor, not my grandma either, even though her opinions are usually right. And let me just make sure we're clear here. There's been no concession that Dr. Vogel isn't an expert. The concession was that he probably wasn't qualified on standard of care issues, but he was going to be a witness in the case. He's an internist, and he was going to testify on damages. He's a qualified expert. It might be debatable whether he could go beyond that into some standard of care issues, but counsel recognized that under Narski, rather than take the risk that he's wrong, that his opinions on qualification are wrong, he went out and got a dentist so that there was no question about it. He bulletproofed, basically, the qualification issue out of fear that, unlike Narski, he can't argue that Dr. Vogel is qualified, and if it turns out he's wrong, which is certainly a reasonable possibility, he can't fix it. He has to fix it beforehand under 145.6A2. So that's exactly what he did. He looked at Narski. He says, okay, I can add another expert on the standard of care issue. I can add a dentist. I better do that just to be safe, even though Dr. Vogel is an expert. I am going to call him on other issues, and maybe I could argue that he's qualified, but that's too risky under the 145 statutory scheme, so I'm not going to do that. In Norski, that's exactly what counsel did. They argued first that the expert against Joe Friedberg was qualified, even though he had not tried criminal cases. And the court said, you're wrong. He's not qualified. But the court didn't say, and because he's not qualified, the affidavit doesn't count at all. The court said, no, you can fix it. Now that the judge has ruled that your expert is not qualified, you get 90 days under that legislative scheme to name a qualified expert. And that's exactly what happened in Norski. And Judge Dietzen wrote the opinion that that was an appropriate method for curing that problem. If it's curable there, it should be curable here. There's no real difference. And indeed, Dr. Vogel is an expert. You know, he happens to be Ms. Wesley's treating internist and has been deeply involved in this treating this problem she has.
Whole issue of this particular statute I find absolutely baffling to me is the way it's developed. Is it my understanding in the mid-80s when this statute was enacted, it was done so not only with the tacit but the explicit support of the plaintiff's bar?
It was, Your Honor.
In order to just kind of streamline and set up and make more clear how these malpractice cases proceed. Now, our court in the late 90s developed a number of cases and saying is that this statute was intended to cut with a sharp, clean knife and to be it's either or. And it's my understanding the statute now that we're dealing with was enacted subsequent to and following those cases to allow for some correction. And in fact, as I read the statute, it appears to be rather broad because it is intended that we get to cases on their merits and not make this a, I mean, we are a notice pleading state after all. And is that a correct summary of the history of how this particular statute is developed?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The cases that had been dismissed under 145.682 before the safe harbor provision were dismissed for qualification deficiencies, they were dismissed for standard of care deficiencies, and they were dismissed for chain of causation deficiencies. And the majority opinions in many of those cases used language like, there was no meaningful disclosure. The concurrences and dissents in many of those cases thought there was meaningful disclosure. And that's the problem with where we draw this line. But what is clear is the legislature said, we want to give plaintiffs a chance to fix those problems, whatever we call them, whether they're meaningful disclosure or not, whether they're qualification problems, standard of care problems, or chain of causation deficiencies, plaintiffs get a chance to fix it. The purpose of the statute is to get rid of frivolous cases, not to get rid of meritorious cases. And so we give plaintiffs 45 days to fix the deficiencies, whether they're qualification, standard of care, or chain of causation deficiencies, period. And it softened, if you will, that sharp edge, and which was cutting, at least arguably, into clearly meritorious cases that could, and the affidavits could be fixed, and the merit, and the case could be resolved on the merits. And that is clearly the legislative history.
Now, counsel, is that I want to focus on is that your expert here on the first affidavit.
Yes, sir.
And he is indeed a, is a he, right?
Yes, sir.
Is a physician.
He is a physician. He's a specialist in internal medicine, and he treated Ms. Wesley's jaw problems.
And so he was a treating physician who treated her health problem that it was a result of the actions that are part of this case?
Yes, Your Honor. And he expressed opinions that those problems arose when the dentist in this case put too much pressure on Ms. Wesley's jaw for too long and broke it or dislocated it. And the dentist who was subsequently disclosed agrees with that.
So why wasn't that enough? Why didn't you go forward with the expert that you had?
Because he isn't a dentist, and on the standard of care issues, plaintiff's counsel could be wrong. And you don't dare gamble under 145.682. Unlike 544.42, where you get to wait until to see how the judge rules, and then you can fix the problem. Under 145.682, you better fix the problem first, and don't be arrogant. And I'm talking about plaintiff's counsel. Don't think you're right.
Well, that's another thing about the two different statutes here. One is before court involvement, and the other is at the point of or after court involvement.
Yes, sir.
Is that a meaningful distinction in how these two statutes set up?
No. Not with regard to the concept of what deficiencies can you cure.
There's well, I'm just wondering, is the purpose of the statute we're talking about here is to more of an informal type situation? Lawyers, you correct it before you get to the court, if you can.
If you can. I don't think it's less formal, Your Honor. I think we still...
Well, the results are not less formal. I mean, you roll the dice. But,
yes, sir.
But doesn't this statute that we're talking put more impetus in the camp of the plaintiff's lawyer? If you got some idea of a problem, get it fixed?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Can you... I just want to understand the basic structure of the statute, because as I understand it, if you file your expert affidavit and your serve your summons and complaint, if the defense never objects to the sufficiency of your affidavit, at some point they no longer have the right to object.
Well, actually,
except
I don't...
Except for the fact that the expert, when testifying, doesn't meet the standards for giving an expert opinion on the subject.
Actually, Your Honor, the defense can wait until trial and when the witness is on the stand, now challenge the qualifications of the expert to render standard of care opinions.
Well, and isn't that sometimes a good strategy in these cases? I mean, here the defense said, wait a minute, your expert isn't qualified.
It
alerts the plaintiff to a potential deficiency, and then the plaintiff has some time to cure.
I think the record suggests that Mr. Zimmer had come into the case late and already recognized the problem and was in the process of trying to correct the deficiency, perhaps even before the motion was brought. And so the hand was already tipped, if you will, Your Honor. But absolutely, in some cases, the best defense strategy is not to challenge it under 145.682, where the plaintiff gets an opportunity to cure, but to wait until trial, lay in the weeds, if you will, and then if the expert is not qualified, to keep the testimony out and get a directed verdict. Obviously, at trial, the ability to cure is quite different than under 145.682. But in this case, defense counsel elected to bring the challenge under 145.682, and the statute is very clear in saying deficiencies get to be corrected.
Let me ask you this. There's some statutory language that I don't know if informs our decision or not, but 145.682, subdivision 4, of course, talks about how to identify the experts. And then sub 4B says nothing in this subdivision may be construed to prevent either party from calling additional experts or substituting other experts. What is that statutory section directed specifically?
Two points, Your Honor. It simply, by negative implication, it says there is a right to substitute or add experts. That exists here. And then there's this subdivision 4, and it says nothing in this subdivision takes away that right. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean the right doesn't exist out there. It exists out there. The right to substitute or add experts exists. And nothing in the subdivision is intended to change that. So we have the right, under, as I read the statute, to add or substitute experts. When at the Court of Appeals, Justice Dietzen thought that language in the parallel statute, 544.42, was important. And he cites it in the opinion saying, this is further evidence of the ability of plaintiff's counsel to add or substitute experts. And if you follow the scheme carefully, you can either substitute or add experts all the way through until after the trial judge issues a scheduling order giving deadlines. After that deadline, you can still substitute experts.
Well, let me ask you a question about that provision. It uses a language which I think is very interesting of, quote, substituting other expert witnesses, which to me, to the extent it applies to subdivision 4A, means that you had an expert witness identified in the first place. Why is that reading wrong? I mean, it talks about other expert witnesses. It doesn't talk about additional expert witnesses or something of that nature. It assumes that there's an expert witness in the first place.
Actually, if you go back a little bit, Your Honor, it says calling additional, nothing in the subdivision should be construed to prevent either party from calling additional expert witnesses or substituting other expert witnesses. So you can either add or substitute. In this case, Mr. Zimmer added. He added an expert. He had Dr. Vogel, and it's clear in the record that he was going to call Dr. Vogel on some issues, that Dr. Vogel was an expert he was going to use. What he conceded was there was a problem on the standard of care qualification. So he added an expert. But I don't think the ability to add or substitute an expert exists independent of that language. That language simply says this subdivision doesn't take that away.
What are we to do with opposing counsel's argument that under your reading of the statute, essentially we're converting this into a 225-day statute, or I don't remember the number, but, you know, this 45 days is just being added. 225 days is now how long you have, because your first affidavit can be worthless as a matter of fact, but because you've substituted another one on objection. I mean, is it your position that the statute puts the burden on the defense to raise an objection to a worthless affidavit, or, you know, I mean, how do we avoid the problem, and maybe it isn't a problem, of this more or less automatically extending the time the plaintiff has to submit the affidavit of a qualified expert?
It's what the legislature intended. Under 544.42, you get 90 days after the judge finds a deficiency to correct the deficiency. Under 145.682, you get 45 days after the motion is brought to correct the alleged deficiency. The legislature, under both of those schemes, said in one you get an extra 90 days after the judge has ruled, in the other you get 45 days after the motion is brought. They could have said it's 225 days rather than 180 days. It's just what the legislature outlined as the appropriate way to address these issues. You got 180 days to get an affidavit of an expert out there, and if it's challenged, you know, get 45 more days to fix it. Under the other scheme, you get, and I don't have in my head exactly the time frame, I think it's also 180 days, and after the judge rules it's deficiency, you get an extra 90 days to fix it. If you can't fix it, it's a frivolous case. If you can fix it, it's a meritorious case. We want to resolve, the legislature concludes, we want to resolve these issues on the merits, and that's how we're going to do it. We're going to give plaintiff's counsel an opportunity to fix it. I see my time is up. I've tried to reserve some time.
Yes, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hart.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court and counsel. My name is Bill Hart, and I represent Dr. David Floor and Uptown Dental in this case. The question presented for the court today is whether the failure to identify a qualified expert within 180 days of suit forecloses a cure under the safe harbor provision of MnSTAT section.
Let me see if we can just get some basic ground covered here. I gather that there is, at least for purposes of our proceeding here, there's no challenge to the affidavit provided with the summons and complaint, and we're talking only about the affidavit, 180-day affidavit. Am I correct about that?
Yes.
Then the second question I would have for you is with respect to the argument that the cure provision provides no identification of exempted deficiencies. Or to put another way, how do you respond to appellant's argument that it says deficiencies? This expert witness is a deficient, the failure to identify the correct expert, if we assume that's what happened here, that's just a deficiency. They have just as much right to fix that as any other deficiency. How do you respond to that?
Well, there's three things, Your Honor, that I would start with the broad and move down to the specific provisions in the statute itself. We start with the broad because we know that in construing a statute, what we're trying to find out is what is the intention of the legislature in drafting this statute. And we know from the earliest cases that this court decided on this subject, the Stroud and the Sorensen cases, that there's really two overriding things that the legislature intended, that it's the umbrella under which all of the construction of the statute really needs to be undertaken. And those two things, really simple. It has to be well-founded within 180 days of suit. That comes from the Stroud case. And the most important thing about having a well-founded case within 180 days is the identity of a willing expert. And that comes from the Sorensen case. So those are the things that...
And not to push you on that a little bit, which of course means I'm about to push you on this a little bit, is, you know, those early cases predate the deficiency cure provision
right.
that we're talking about here. So it seems to me that they're not of much help here. Am I right or wrong about that?
Well, I hate to just say you're wrong, but I think...
Go right ahead. People do it all the time.
The... The legislature, in providing a cure provision, didn't intend to undermine the basic purposes of the statute. It simply meant to allow for some relaxation in certain situations. Otherwise, as the question came up earlier, it simply would have said, okay, now you have 225 days instead of 180. But when you look specifically at what the statute says, and bearing in mind now the broad umbrella under which we're looking at the statute provides the threshold for getting into the safe harbor provision is a deficiency in the affidavit. It's not any kind of deficiency, it's a deficiency in the affidavit. And one of the observations made by the concurrence in the
Council, you got to make that distinction more clear to me.
Okay.
I got to figure out, you know, what is a broader, narrow definition deficiency? And you're making a distinction here, and I'm quite frankly not seeing it that clearly, so you got to help me out.
Sure. Your Honor, in the concurrence, in the special concurrence in the Bram case, the Bram versus Mayo Clinic case, the court said that Mayo doesn't challenge the sufficiency of the content of Wick's disclosure, but only Wick's qualifications. So that's the distinction I'm making. And the concurrence uses emphasis on the word content, and that's what the statute is emphasizing as well when it says deficiencies in the affidavit. And the lack of qualifications is not a deficiency in the affidavit. It's separate from it. It's the ability of the person to even give the opinions that are stated in the affidavit. There may be nothing wrong with it. You may have an affidavit that has.
So it's really fundamental. It's the most fundamental question is, do you have an
most fundamental.
Well, and so that's why I don't understand, if the legislature intended to create a safe harbor, why they would say, well, you didn't get a notary to sign the affidavit and you get into the safe harbor. But when the defense side says, wait a minute, you don't have an expert who's going to give an opinion or who's potentially deficient, I mean, the safe harbor doesn't end up to be much of a safe harbor. These cases are all about who the expert is and whether they're qualified. It has very little to do with, did you meet the technical requirements of the affidavit? You know, did you? I mean, that's what we're left with under your reading is, was it served properly? And then we get into, was it served? And then did it have the right signatures? And sort of technical stuff.
No, that's not what we're talking about. I mean, you know, there are other things. The content of the affidavit, you know, there's got to be some substance in there. But by definition, if you're not qualified, the substance is meaningless. And remember, under Brown.
Well, what if the plaintiff thinks the expert's qualified? I mean, this isn't just they named their neighbor or their grandmother.
I understand.
I mean, they said, okay, I've got an internist who's been treating me for this condition, and I think they're qualified to give an opinion.
Well, that's why.
File the affidavit. The defense says, wait a minute, we don't think they're qualified. They get another look at it and say, you know, I think we're running a risk here. We better tighten up this opinion, or else this will be dismissed as the statute would have intended, and this doctor will no longer be subject to this litigation.
I understand. That really leads me to a discussion of that Noski case that the plaintiffs are relying on, because the Noski case, there are several reasons why Noski doesn't have any controlling effect here, and the first and foremost reason is in answer to your question. Under the initial affidavit requirement, the affidavit of expert review, the statute provides that you have to certify that you have a reasonable expectation that the expert's opinion could be admissible at trial. That's the standard under the affidavit of expert review. And so, Your Honor, if you were to import that standard into the second disclosure, which is kind of the subject of your question, then you would be basically making the second disclosure subject to the same standards as the first, even though the legislature has specifically separated the two out. So, yeah, when it comes to the first affidavit, sure, it has it's the reasonable expectation that the expert's opinion could be admissible at trial. And so when the court in Noski looked at that substitution...
Counsel, can I just pause for a minute? Is that I'm not sure what the correct pronunciation, but my Norwegian ancestors are turning in the grave when they pronounce it Noski. It's either Norsk or Norski. And, I mean, Noski is just having celebrated the resistance of the Norwegians to the Nazi invasion. My ancestors would have a little problem with that pronunciation. Small point, but I find it slightly off to
I went with a phonetic pronunciation,
you?
Your Honor. Okay, so getting back to just to the substance of Noski, that's why Noski's different, because under Noski, under the initial review statute...
Well, you know, I don't want to focus on Noski because it's a Court of Appeals
right.
decision.
That's
and,
another...
I mean... I'm looking at the statute
okay, but
as a whole, and I'm saying, why isn't this exactly what this safe harbor was intended? It's to you know, you've got this narrow funnel of cases that can go forward, and then the statute, as I see it, provided temporary relief from the sharp edge of that and said, okay, we're going to give you a certain number of days to cure these cure deficiencies. And I just mean, why isn't the qualification of an expert a deficiency that can be cured? And just based on this, on the statutory language.
Sure, and that's what I was talking about, was the statutory language. There's a difference in the statutory language between the affidavit of expert review, and that informs your question. It's in the affidavit of expert review, it's just this the reasonable expectation of the... of the person who's filing the affidavit, whereas under Brown-Wilbert...
I guess that's where you lose me. It seems to me that at worst it's implied in Subdivision 4 that the expert be qualified, and to say that that's not part of 4 and is only limited to 3, then it seems to me we're in a circumstance where you didn't object under Subdivision 3, and so you've waived that.
But remember, Your Honor, under Subdivision 3, if you don't file any affidavit at all, if you do nothing to satisfy the statute, you're still entitled to 60 days to do something after demand. And that's the whole point of Brown-Wilbert, is you have to minimally satisfy the 180-day requirement before you're entitled to anything. That's the point of Brown-Wilbert. And it's
then
different under Subdivision 3 because you don't have to do that.
It seems to me we still come back to Subdivision 4 and Subdivision 6 and what does the legislature intend. And I guess I just would follow up with what Justice Meyer said, and what is it about this language in 4 or 6 that precludes an amendment to an affidavit when the expert is, quote, not qualified?
Sure. Well, and that's the focus of our brief, of course, where we talk about the only method by which cure is allowed is by amendment. And here what they're trying to do is they're not trying to amend what has been said before, add to it, or fix it. They're simply trying to start from scratch after the 180-day deadline. And that's specifically what Brown-Wilbert talked about. Specifically, they said, the Brown-Wilbert court said, if you don't have to minimally satisfy the statute within 180 days, then that provision is meaningless.
Well, let's pursue this for a moment. Let's assume for the moment that that we buy your argument that somehow there's something different about the failure to correctly identify the type of expert. Are there other kinds of things that's not mentioned anywhere in the statute, but are there other kinds of things that are so fundamental that they would also fall into that category? And I have in mind, for example, Some of our decisions in this area were quite critical of affidavits that completely blew the in the eyes of the court at the time, blew the causation link, that there was no causation here. There's nothing more critical to a negligence claim than causation. So why wouldn't that also fall into this category of something that,
I mean, you got the correct
expert identified, but the expert completely missed the causal link. So
right. Well, Your Honor, that's the test. The test under Brown-Wilbert gets applied to everything. And the test under Brown-Wilbert is there meaningful disclosure on everything that will be necessary to show at trial in order to avoid a directed verdict? And so the causation, it has to be a meaningful disclosure. And so, if you meet the standard of Brown-Wilbert, yes, you get to substitute. And if you don't, you don't. But the difference between all those other things that you're talking about and this thing, qualifications, the difference is that everything you say in the affidavit is meaningless if the person can't come to trial and satisfy the standards for a directed verdict. Everything is meaningless.
That's
because
in the causation context as well. You're going to get a directed
Exactly. But that's true. But there's a continuum of information on these other elements that you may need to look at on a continuum basis. And that's why the court in Brown-Wilbert said, "Hey, this is a difficult line to draw, and here's where we're drawing it."
Let me pursue the Brown-Wilbert point a little bit here. Why does it apply in this context at all, given the fact that these are two different statutory schemes?
Sure. Well, when you look at Brown-Wilbert, you read Brown-Wilbert, the decision leaves no doubt in the reader's mind that the analysis is interchangeable between the two statutes. Because and as counsel said today, there's nothing meaningfully different about the two that affects this analysis. And so, in fact, really, the under 544, it's a more lenient standard for cure under 544, and yet still, the court came down in Brown-Wilbert with the minimal standards test. And so, I would say that because the statute is more liberal in 544, that's a stronger reason to apply the Brown-Wilbert analysis to 145. Than it even was in the Brown-Wilbert case itself, but there's nothing meaningfully different between the two that would allow for a decision different in this case and have those two cases be able to be consistent.
Let me ask you that. Oh, go ahead.
No.
I was just going to say, what about subdivision 4B? I asked opposing counsel about this. Nothing in the subdivision may be construed to prevent either party from calling additional expert witnesses, and I'm assuming that your position is calling additional expert witnesses can only happen at trial, but then or substituting other expert witnesses.
Sure.
Was there such a provision in Brown-Wilbert?
I believe there is a provision in Brown-Wilbert in the 544 statute. I don't know if there is. I'd have to look.
Fair enough.
I don't have it highlighted here, but I believe there is.
Well, why doesn't that language on its face allow what happened here? Substituting other expert witnesses. Why aren't they just substituting a dentist here for a general practitioner, which is exactly what's allowed by subdivision 4B?
Sure, because that just begs the question as to whether there was an expert to begin with. You can't substitute or add an expert if you never had one to begin with. And that goes back to the overarching concepts that we started with. The purpose, the overall purpose of this statute was to assure that cases, to verify that cases are well-founded within 180 days of suit. And the most important thing, and that's...
Counsel, which statute? The 86 statute, which had the 180 days, or the amendment, which added 45 days. I mean, well, you got to say the purpose of the statute was to put it within 180 days. I guess I want you to be specific as to which statute.
Well, and that gets right back to Brown-Wilbert, Your Honor, because if we say that the legislature really meant to add 45 days to every case, then Brown-Wilbert can't be reconciled with it, because Brown-Wilbert says you have to minimally you have to minimally meet the disclosure requirements within 180 days, or you're not entitled to the cure.
Well, then why didn't you make a motion on that basis? I mean, your motion was the affidavit is deficient.
Sure.
I mean, why by definition, then, isn't the affidavit deficient? I mean, you invoked that section of the statute. You didn't invoke, you didn't say, Your Honor, this needs to be dismissed because there was no affidavit, essentially. There was no affidavit filed. You know, this expert is unqualified, and there's just...
That's exactly what we did. This is the equivalent
of no affidavit.
Yeah, that's exactly what we argued.
Well, actually, you argued Subdivision 6. The motion was brought under Subdivision 6.
Well, sure, because...
You said this is a deficient affidavit, but...
Sure, and...
So
and
you want to argue deficient affidavit on the one hand, but then
that's,
you
that's
want
like,
to say that means that there is the equivalent of no affidavit.
You know, that would be, I think, what we're talking about there then would be what is the form of your motion versus what is the substance of your motion? The substance of our motion is it doesn't satisfy the statute.
But
and
didn't
so,
you conduct yourself as though this was a defect that was curable? I mean, you gave notice. You said, look, you have, this is a defect and you should cure it.
That's how you would do it, Your Honor, without so that you won't get a district court who says, gee, I don't think I can look at this because you didn't give this notice. I don't think you can. So you kind of go, you know, you foreclose those kinds of arguments by just simply doing the most liberal thing allowed under the statute. But, you know, the idea here is we're looking to see if there's a basis, any basis, to affirm the judgment of the district court. And so, you know, the precise form of the motion that came before the court is really of no importance,
Counsel,
so long as the substance of it is correct under the law, and that's what we're doing here in the Supreme Court.
I have two questions for you. Did you, in your motion, invoke Subdivision 6A, which is failure to comply with Subdivision 2, Clause 1?
I don't know.
Does Subdivision 6A preclude a new affidavit that identifies, in this case, a different expert?
Well, I think it does. I mean, I think that I think it does because you don't get to be unless you have minimally satisfied the statute within 180 days, and so you have to stop at A if you don't get into B, and that's exactly what Brown-Wilbert said.
I'm just looking at the language of the statute, and it says that failure to comply with Subdivision 2, Clause 1 within 60 days after demand for the affidavit results, and then it goes on, in mandatory dismissal. And I guess the question that I have is, after you make your motion under Subdivision 6A, doesn't the statute contemplate that the plaintiff can submit a new affidavit identifying a qualified expert?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I misunderstood your question because I assumed I knew what section you were talking about. Subdivision A is the first affidavit. And so that's the Narski case. And that has completely different bona fides to it because it's a way different standard when you ask, did the person reasonably believe that the expert testimony could be admissible at trial? That's way different from the Brown-Wilbert standard, which measures compliance by what would be necessary at trial to avoid a directed verdict. So those two things are completely different.
I'd like to go back to the Brown-Wilbert standard issue. And I want to suggest to you that your argument carried to its logical conclusion eviscerates the legislative decision to the legislative action to provide an opportunity to cure. In Brown-Wilbert, what Justice Hansen writes there is that the concern is, it's a substantive concern. It has nothing to do with the identification of the expert. So that's one difference between our cases. But he talks about does not identify or define any specific accounting standard of care, state how accountants deviated from that standard of care, or allege how that deviation caused injury. Now, I would submit to you that the affidavits that we have before us in this case, setting aside the question of whether or not it's a dentist or an internist, they're not guilty of that offense. You know, we've got the manipulation of the jaw, we've got the discussion of the standard of care. It's something very different than what was talked about in Brown-Wilbert. So tell me again why Brown-Wilbert controls here in light of that, and tell me also why, if it does control, what's left to be dealt with by this statute that the legislature enacted in 2002.
Sure, Your Honor. If you accept that the 180-day provision doesn't need to be met, then Brown-Wilbert is wrongly decided, and these two cases then could be rectified with one another. Under Brown-Wilbert, you have to minimally satisfy the statutory requirement within 180 days in order to be entitled to. And it doesn't matter what the, you know, what the deficiency is, whether it's as to causation or whether it's as to qualifications or whatever. If you don't minimally satisfy, and the court defined what that meant, if you don't minimally satisfy it within 180 days, the safe harbor provision is inapplicable. That is the holding in Brown-Wilbert. And under Sorensen...
Counsel, at this point, is you don't minimally satisfy, as I'm reading that to say, is you have to have come up with a name within that 180 days of someone who will testify to all of the things that are required. And the logical conclusion would be, if your rule is that you can only supplement it by additional statements by the affid that you've identified within 180 days. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, I couldn't follow it.
Your game, set, match, if within the 180 days you have not identified the individual who can meet all the standards.
An individual who can meet all the standards, not the one. An individual.
An individual. I mean, but, you know, it's you have to identify that individual within 180 days.
Right. And otherwise you have...
No substitution, no change after 180 days with respect to the individual identified.
No. No, so long as the individual is qualified and you have met the minimum standards within 180 days, then you can get into the safe harbor provision, then the provision about substitutions and so forth can apply, but you can't get into the safe harbor unless you have, within 180 days of suit, a minimally qualified disclosure that will meet every element that is necessary to avoid a directed verdict at trial. And that by definition, that's why the qualification is the bedrock of that test. Because by definition, nothing said in that affidavit could be used at trial to avoid a directed verdict, because it's not being offered by someone who could go there and do it.
Counsel, I want to ask you why the issue of the nature of the deficiency, I mean, why can't it be that whatever deficiency the defense identifies, whatever it is, can be corrected? So that's what the legislature intended.
Right, because that...
Whatever deficiency you choose as defense counsel to identify, the
right.
Plaintiff has 45 days to fix it.
Sure. And the reason is, and that's exactly what Brown-Wilbert said, that would render the 180-day provision meaningless, and we declined to do that. That was precisely what the court said. And then it said after that, all right, now it's hard to know where to draw the line. This is difficult. We're not going to allow you within 180 days to fall below to have a meaningless disclosure. And so the difficulty, the court said, is where do we draw the line? And the court said, here's the test. The test is you have to have meaningful disclosure on every element that will be necessary at trial to be proved in order to avoid a directed verdict. And it can't be meaningful if the person who's saying it isn't qualified to say it. That is the very essence of Brown-Wilbert, and it goes back right to Sorensen, the very first case where the court in Sorensen said the most important disclosure is the identity of the expert. If you haven't identified someone who is an expert, you failed the most basic standard of the statute.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. Mr.
Thank
Wade,
you
have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
If we accept a learned counsel's argument that there is a minimally acceptable disclosure, we haven't given any respect to the safe harbor provision whatsoever, because the minimum requirements articulated is exactly what the law was before the safe harbor provision.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? I was actually a little confused about the prior exchange, but it actually goes more towards your case than the other side, which is this affidavit under subdivision 4 doesn't have to be a single individual. It can be multiple individuals. You could have multiple individuals testify as to all the elements of the claim, or you could have an individual expert testify only as to causation, another as to the standard of care. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, of course. Indeed, in the great majority of complex cases, there may be 5 or 6 or 7 affidavits of counsel that are signed by, also signed by each of the experts. Answers to interrogatories may disclose 4, 5, 10 experts. The experts will, each of the experts will sign the answers to interrogatories. It's still the answers to interrogatories of the party. Plaintiff's counsel signs as well. Satisfies the statute.
Well, counsel, let me focus on respondent's argument here. It's granted it's a more narrowly focused view of the amendment that adds the 45 days, but saying you have your chance to, the underlying purpose here is to avoid frivolous lawsuits. Malpractice insurance, everything, cut it off before you go through this whole sequence of trial and maybe forced settlements of trial. No, if you don't have a meritorious case, cut it off early. And as that I would understand, as the respondents are saying, is that you have 180 days to identify somebody who can really address these issues that eliminate the question of frivolousness. Now, sometimes, you got the individual, but your affidavit isn't properly drafted. So the purpose here is, get them to say what needs to be said under statute, not go out and troll for another expert. Why is that not a reasonable interpretation here of what this statute deals with?
It is a perfectly reasonable interpretation before the safe harbor provision. That was the law before the safe harbor provision. If that's still the law, we have not respected the legislature's intent to give plaintiffs a chance to cure. The law.
But you would, wouldn't you? Is that the affidavit on its surface is not sufficient? Go back to your identified expert and have them say what they need to say, and if they can't, well, then it's game, set, match.
The statute doesn't say that. If the challenge is on qualifications, the only way I can fix it is to get a different expert. I can go back to the same expert on other issues, on standard of care, chain of causation, and I can flesh that out. But if the challenge is on qualifications, now we're back with the old law before the safe harbor. It's game, set, and match in Your Honor's terms.
Well, what is there about the new law that the linchpin here to your argument is qualifications and allows you to go back and correct qualifications? What is there about the new law, the amended law, that would say explicitly this is what is contemplated here?
It says you can correct claim deficiencies challenged under the statute.
So it turns on deficiencies, how broadly or narrowly you define deficiencies.
I suppose, Your Honor. But certainly this court has held historically that qualifications is a 145.682 deficiency and has held and has dismissed under the statute on that's really Tefeteller stands for that proposition.
Why aren't plaintiffs adequately protected by the fact that this is something that the plaintiff could have noticed earlier, right? You could have said, out of an abundance of caution, we know the general practitioners may not be able to testify as to this. Now, we know under the statute that plaintiff's counsel can disclose multiple witnesses, even testifying about the same thing. And so why aren't plaintiffs adequately protected by the fact that you can put multiple witnesses or multiple expert witnesses in affidavit? You don't even need the safe harbor provision if you comply with the terms of the statute. So why isn't respondent's rule correct?
The same can be said for the other elements, Your Honor. Why didn't plaintiff get it right? Okay, why didn't they get it right on the qualifications? Why didn't they get it right on chain of causation? Why didn't they get it right on standard of care? Because sometimes plaintiff's counsel is wrong and misses the mark. And neglect, but simply because they view it one way. We have very good counsel on the other side. They fly-spec these affidavits. They bring up issues that went over our head, and the legislature has clearly said we get to fix it.
Let's talk a little bit about Brown-Wilbert.
Yes, sir.
I'd be interested in, rather than a long, complicated question from me, just what's your response to the argument you heard about Brown-Wilbert, and why doesn't it apply here, how do you respond to that?
Yes, sir. Justice Hansen was very careful in Brown-Wilbert in saying, be careful about drawing analogies between the 544 section, the 140, because the histories are different. There hasn't been under the 544 provisions this line of cases dismissing matters for a qualification, standard of care, and chain of causation. And then the legislature coming in and saying, we want to fix that so plaintiffs get a chance to fix those cases, those qualification cases, chain of causation, standard of care cases. The legislature comes in and changes that under the medical malpractice statute. That wasn't true under the other. So we didn't have this body of case law that informs what the intent of the language of the legislature was in the safe harbor. It is clear that legislature's safe harbor was intended to give plaintiffs a chance to fix the kind of cases that were being dismissed historically before that. That's
Counsel,
not true
I
under the 544 section. We don't have that body of case. So in the malpractice case, we can really look at these cases and say, okay, here are the cases the court was dismissing under the statute. The legislature says we want to give plaintiffs a chance to fix those kinds of cases.
The counsel, what I guess that begs the question for me, and I guess maybe it's a question of bookends. Do you concede that an affidavit by my neighbor isn't the type of deficiency that the legislature intended to allow to be corrected?
Yes, Your Honor, and that brings me right back to Brown-Wilbert. We all know what a placeholder is. A placeholder is not an expert affidavit. It really isn't. And I would suggest that what Justice Hansen was really articulating was that the affidavit in Brown-Wilbert was a placeholder. A placeholder is, I have an expert retained, he's an economist, he's Dr. Jones, and I'm going to give you his opinions pretty soon. And his opinions will probably support my complaint. That's a placeholder. That's not an affidavit of expert review with substantive opinions. And I actually think that's what Justice Hansen was attempting to articulate. I would agree that a placeholder has no purpose and ought not be allowed. But we don't have a placeholder here. This is not a placeholder. There are solid disclosures here.
Counsel, getting back to the linchpin of deficiency means qualifications. And the answer that respondents said, no, you look at Brown-Wilbert, and that doesn't define it. Is your argument that deficiency gets defined by the sequence of cases that led up to the 45-day statutory amendment?
The ability to correct deficiency certainly does, Your Honor. Yes, it does.
Do we look at those cases to inform us as to the definition of deficiency in the medical malpractice more so than we would look to Brown-Wilbert as to?
Exactly, Your Honor. And in fact, and I know it's in the brief, but the legislative history is so important here. I think Senator now Judge Neville said occasionally some mistakes are made in the affidavits. He doesn't say little mistakes, big mistakes. He doesn't say qualification error, standard of care quality. He says mistakes are made in the affidavit. And motions to dismiss with prejudice are made after the 180 days, where in circumstances where the affidavit could have been corrected. It was a meritorious case, but the affidavit is, he says, not deficient. I think he meant not sufficient. and there's no chance to fix it. What this bill does is provide 45 days. No matter when the motion to dismiss is brought, you get 45 days. They have to identify the deficiency. In the affidavit or the answers to interrogatories, and a curing or supplemental expert affidavit could be filed before the hearing. That's the legislative history.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you. Thanks to both counsel for your help in this case. This matter is submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course. We're in recess.